Howdy-do, buckaroos. Welcome to the Daily Observations podcast from the Mac Observer. This is Thursday, November 8th, 2018. With me today, I have John Martellaro. Hi, John.
Hi, good morning. How are you, Kelly?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm doing great. Nice to be here.
Yeah. We're going to talk about a couple of topics today, and we do have a couple of sponsors. I want to start with something that, John, you and I kicked around a little earlier, and that was A-series processors, which are not novel, but putting them in laptops, which or in other, you know, air quote computer hardware, because we're sort of we're seeing that that definition gets mushier all the time. We're talking about putting these in a MacBook or a MacBook Pro or eventually perhaps an iMac. Let's talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, we've been seeing more and more evidence about that over the years. This rumor has been percolating around for maybe a year or two, and we hear bits and pieces, and the more we hear and the different sources we hear it from, and the more sense it seems to make within the strategic picture that Apple's creating, the more we believe it, although, you know, there's been no announcement from Apple. And the latest evidence we've heard was about a month ago from Ming-Chao Kuo, a securities analyst, who predicted that Apple would start moving to the ARM processors in the MacBooks, the low-end, the portables, in 2020, and then eventually go to the desktops.
Now, before we go too far down the road with him, let's just point out that Ming-Chao Kuo has been right a number of times about what he's been right about, and he has been spectacularly wrong on more than one occasion. So
he was right about the Mac Mini at the October 30 event,
but not the iPad Mini, because he said we were getting one of those too, which did not happen. So he's 50-50 on the Mini.
He was right about USB-C on the iPad Pro.
Yes.
Yeah.
But wrong about new AirPods. So, like, you know, like when he says something, you kind of have to just sort of... What's interesting is you can sort of... He's a good barometer for other people's agendas, because other people will report on what he says, and then you see them go, but obviously he's wrong because he's wrong all the time, which means whatever it is he said, that person sort of disagrees with. And then sometimes if somebody's like, and he's right about stuff, you know, constantly, then like this is maybe a theory that that person agrees with. So it's kind of a nice way to measure sometimes what...
I just take it as another data point.
Yeah, you know, I do too. Because he doesn't bat a thousand on any of this stuff. So
who does?
Exactly. But I do agree with you that I think it's coming. But a thing that I hadn't really thought about was the mounting evidence, which is the part that when you started getting into was the part that got me actually interested in thinking that this might be reality. So what's your conclusion, which is the part that actually got me to agree with you?
Well, one of the bits in this constellation of data is Marzipan. That's a software developer technology Apple has created that allows developers to bring iOS apps running on A-series and recompile them over to the Mac for Intel architecture.
And for people who aren't maybe familiar, this is technology that's been announced by Apple. They announced it at WWDC 2018, earlier this year. And it's not available to anybody yet. They told us it was coming next year, but Apple themselves are able to use it, which is why the Mac App Store now looks much more familiar, because it looks like the iTunes App Store that you get on your mobile devices. And Apple News has now come to the Mac, and
Stocks.
The Stocks widget.
Is there Notes or something?
And I want to say there
showcase apps.
Yeah, there was one more, but I can't remember what the other one was. But that's what we're talking about, is the possibility of being able to take... It's now a much less complex task to take something you have that runs on iOS and its accompanying hardware and put that on macOS and its accompanying hardware, even though they're very different.
Right. And so it would make sense at some point for the developers to be able to simply switch frameworks instead of frameworks plus CPU architecture,
mm-hmm.
and take those iOS apps that we're running on the iPad under, what is the kit? Is it iOS kit versus app kit? Something like that. So mm-hmm. there's two different developer frameworks for the two different, whether it's touch or whether it's mouse.
Right.
And convert over to run, and there'll be some minor penalty running your iOS apps that were designed to run on ARM and bring them over to Intel, but that would go away if
mm-hmm.
you had the Acer's architecture in the Mac. And there are some gotchas, but we've been through those gotchas before. You know, you got legacy apps that were compiled for Intel. You'd have to have some sort of Rosetta-like translator that you'd be, so you'd be able to run your legacy apps
mm-hmm.
on your Mac that's ARM-based until the developer recompiled, or if the developer never recompiles, they're probably not going to go with the future anyway, and so you'll probably translate to a different app for the future.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's the question of virtual machine hardware. My guess is that at some point in the A13 or the A14, Apple will introduce that so that you can run your virtual machines, again, with instruction translation, so that you can run Windows designed for the Intel architecture on your ARM-based Mac mm-hmm. in a virtual machine. So that's something Apple has fully the capability and the technical wherewithal to do.
Right.
But it gives Apple an advantage. It allows Apple to roll out the computers when they're ready to roll them out.
Mm-hmm.
It gives them a head start on the integration of hardware and software so that they know exactly what the architecture is going to be for the next version of Mac OS. It puts money in Apple's pocket instead of Intel's pocket. Apple's been able to go to 7 nanometers in the production process. That's the size of the transistor gates mm-hmm. on the surface of the CPU, whereas Intel is having trouble getting to 10 nanometers, the family called Cannon Lake.
Mm-hmm.
So Apple thinks that it can do a better job, I think, in terms of cost and performance and integration with their product line. Makes a lot of technical sense.
Well, and a thing I want to say about this that I think is sort of interesting for people who maybe aren't necessarily long-time Apple watchers is that this has happened before in a certain way. Apple used to be part of a partnership with IBM and Motorola, and they were called
the AIM Alliance.
The AIM Alliance. And I think we have to air quote alliance because they never really seemed to get along that well.
It was like the 90s, wasn't it?
It was the 90s, yeah.
Yeah.
And, well, there was the first evolution, which was from the 68K chip to, I don't know what they were called.
PowerPC.
Yeah. It was called them G chips or PowerPC chips. To the PowerPC chip.
I think it was PowerPC, and then there was like the 600 series or something like that.
Yeah.
That Motorola was making, and then IBM came along with a chip that contributed their own, the G3.
Yeah.
So that was Apple's G3
and G4.
From Motorola to IBM. Yeah.
Yeah. And then we got desktop machines that were G5 machines, but they could never figure out how to make a G5 chip for a laptop. And then everything went Intel. It was not too long after Steve came back, we started hearing rumblings about it, and then the Mac Mini was the first Apple hardware to ship with an Intel chip in it. And oh, the angst and the existential terror that everybody had about how this was going to be the end of Apple computer, and it was so terrible. But remember, Steve Jobs had gone on stage and openly mocked Intel for years, so we were all just sort of going on the information that we had, which was Steve said Intel was sucky.
But then in turn,
and then all of a sudden
at IBM,
right?
Remember, IBM promised Steve Jobs that the G5 came out at 2 gigahertz,
mm-hmm.
and IBM made some promises to Steve Jobs about the evolution of the clock speed on the G5 or the successors, and IBM was never able to achieve that.
Right.
And Steve and his team made the technical estimate, as I recall, that IBM was never going to get where they wanted to be in terms of clock performance.
Mm-hmm. Right. So I'm not saying it was wrong, but you know, they went with Intel because Intel was consistently at that point able to do more and more with their chips. Things were faster. They were speedier.
Remember virtual PC? Mm-hmm. Remember the pain of trying to run Windows apps under virtual PC on a Power PC or a G5 Mac?
Just,
it was so painful.
Like, I've made a joke before about, you know, start up that process and then go make a sandwich because it's going to be a while. But that was literally the amount of time it took to make a sandwich.
Being able to run Windows on your Mac was important in that time. I don't know if it's so important now. It's important in a certain way to certain people, but I don't know if it's crucial to the survival of the Mac, because remember, in those days, it was just the Mac.
Right.
And for the Mac to survive, it had to be able to run Windows apps and run Windows.
Or read Windows files in some way so that you were able to translate.
Yeah, either in boot camp or a virtual machine. So that was really important. And that launched the Mac in sort of a more serious way. Whereas before, it was kind of like an outcast. It was like the Sun workstation of the PC world. It was just, you know, you go off and you have your geeky stuff over there and your Unix and your Power PC. But the rest of us real people, we run Intel and Windows. So,
and and that's sort of why this conversation is interesting to me, because we've seen Apple make these fundamental hardware changes over the years. And honestly, that's sort of why I was excited when we got the rumors about the new Mac Mini, because I was sort of hoping that this A-series stuff going into Apple, into computer hardware, like getting off the mobile and onto the desktop, whether it was a laptop or a desktop machine. Because, like I said, the Mac Mini, the initial Mac Mini, was the first machine to have Intel processors in it. And so I was sort of hoping that the new Mac Mini would be the first one to have A-series processors in it, because I thought that would be sort of apropos. And
I think it's going to be the mobiles, though.
Oh, yeah. I think if they
really
do anything
from the low power, yeah.
Yeah, like, it's going to be something like the Air, where what you expect out of that is killer battery life and ultra portability and not necessarily sheer horsepower. So
that's
where like the laptop is going to become ultra portable. Cause like the MacBook Air is supposed to be ultra portable. Like, yeah, it's probably not the best machine for rendering video or, you know, doing serious audio mixdown work or anything like that. But for lighter weight stuff, like, it's meant to be sort of a satellite machine.
But I wonder how far Apple can take this, because my understanding from what I've read, and I'm not an expert, but I've read that when you start getting around 10 or 7 nanometers, you start getting into quantum effects. You get quantum tunneling across traces and other effects that make it difficult to make these artifacts, these gate arrays, smaller and smaller.
Well, they don't have to be smaller if you start putting them in bigger devices.
Well, I'm talking about portables. How far can Apple take this production process, and how far, how much is it going to pay off in time? And
But what I'm saying
where's the real advantage of the wholesale movement over to ARM? Where does the real advantage lay? It may be technically feasible and more appropriate to do it in the portables first, but where it might really pay off is in the desktops, where you can have...
Because you don't have to worry about running them on a battery, for one thing.
That's right. And you can put them together in a parallel processing array and have like a mini cluster of
and they have they tend to have good heat mitigation, so you don't have to really worry about that as much either.
Imagine a group of 4-core A14s and a Mac Pro. And then you have 16 of them. So you have like 64 cores. When in parallel processing mode, that would be awesome.
What I'm thinking is they don't have to make the chips smaller, only because even in like a MacBook, they probably, and I don't know this, I haven't cracked open either one of these to look at for certain, but I would think that they'd have slightly more room to work in the bottom case of a MacBook or a MacBook Pro than they do in the current iteration of the iPad.
I disagree mildly. I don't think you can save a lot of space. These things are about 10 millimeters square. They're about 100 square millimeters. If it's possible to make them smaller, yeah, that's a general trend. They used to be about like 150 square millimeters. But making it a whole lot smaller it just takes away your opportunity for more cache and more computational units and more cores. So
I'm just not sure that they... Like, I feel like the A, because it's the A12 in the new iPad Pro, right? Like, that we just got.
A12X.
A12X, okay. So,
or A1210 if you're an iPhone user.
Or a Mac OS user. So with this chip, like, that's a thing that I've wondered about, is it seems like they wouldn't have to spend a bunch of time to continue to optimize it for, you know, power management and stuff if you're putting it in machines that just plug into the wall. So that should be interesting. I'm very curious where that's going to go, and we will talk more about that as we learn more. Right now, I want to tell you a little bit about our sponsors. Our first sponsor is OpsGenie from Atlassian. Incidents, as everybody knows, are inevitable, and everything comes down to how your company responds. Getting timely alerts is critical when there's an incident, and that's why there's OpsGenie by Atlassian. OpsGenie empowers dev and ops teams to plan for service disruptions and stay in control during incidents. Teams have the power to respond quickly and efficiently, and the right people get notified, and those alerts for those unplanned issues can come from integrations with tools like New Relic and Jira and hundreds more. Visit OpsGenie, OpsGenie, to sign up and get a free company account with up to 5 team members. Our second sponsor today is Jamf Now. Jamf Now helps you set up, protect, and manage your Apple devices on demand. They support macOS and iOS devices like the iMac, the iPhone, and the iPad. That new iPad Pro John and I are talking about. And they let you keep track of the operating system version, the serial number, and you can manage things like email settings and Wi-Fi settings and lots more. 3 devices are free for life, and you can add additional devices for just $2 a month. Head over to the Jamf website at jamf.com and go to jamf.com/TDO and sign up for your free account today. Now, the other thing I want to talk about real quick is we've seen Brian wrote a piece yesterday about how there's been a Pages update, and now Pages can publish directly to iBooks Author, or to the iBooks Store, I mean. And what this leads to is a question about what are we going to do with iBooks Author? What's going to happen to that tool that people were using to publish to the iTunes Store? So,
I have a theory.
Okay. I'm very interested in your theory.
I'm not an expert on iBooks Author, but I've been following it as part of the team and watching the articles and seeing what Apple does. And my theory, it's probably a crackpot theory, is that...
Well, I run a home for those, so by all means.
All right. Apple developed iBooks Author in their own way, with their own agenda, thinking that it would be used by educators in a certain way, and with certain limitations and certain lacks of concessions to people who were in the mainstream, that is, publishing to Amazon. And it didn't take off.
Okay.
Like a lot of products from Apple, it gathers a following that is vehement and committed and loyal. But the broader community says, you know, it's too hard to use, or it doesn't meet my needs in terms of being a publisher at Amazon. So Apple sat back and said, well, what is our core business here? It's certainly not what Amazon is, publishing.
Mm-hmm.
And iBooks Author hasn't really taken off except in a few loyal circles. And those loyal circles are probably what's driving this. Apple would like to probably just move on. But there are some partners who say, well, wait a minute, help us out here. We're committed, and you know, we created this publishing partnership years ago, and we really need this product. And so some engineer in the meeting says, well, I've got this software that I wrote that allows Pages to publish directly to books. With just a little bit of work, I could get it going. And Apple says, okay, well, we'll use that as our workaround for our partner, and that way we don't have to commit to iBooks Author as the end it all, be all, you know, solution for the whole world for book publishing, and that we can get off the hook that way. Now, that's my crackpot theory. It sounds to me like that's what's happening from my experience, you know, from seeing how things go at Apple.
Mm-hmm.
But it explains it an awful lot. It explains iBooks author not having its name changed to Books author for the Apple bookstore.
Yeah, they're not even keeping up with the branding that we've seen evolve in the other places.
Yeah, and I've had a couple of readers and educators talk to me about how it doesn't seem to be holding up. I think it was, I don't want to mention any names and get somebody in trouble, but it was somebody who is in a position to know was telling me in a meeting that he thought iBooks author was dying. So it kind of all fits together.
Well, it certainly seems like it is. Well, I was going to say, not knowing anything doesn't really stop most other people. I find that this feels to me like the iPad mini, for example. We're not going to get rid of it, but it's clear that all of the steps that we're taking are all steps that are evolving past making this necessary, but yeah, we just can't figure out what to do with this, like, appendix of our product.
We don't want to open dock our friends.
Like, that's...
that's an inside joke.
I feel like... And, you know, one thing that I know Brian has said to us, and so I'm paraphrasing him, I'm not quoting him directly, but one thing that Brian said was, having actually spent time in iBooks Author, that you can do really great stuff in iBooks Author, but it's hard. And I wonder if maybe part of the hurdle for a lot of people was iBooks Author. I don't know. I know there are people who have enjoyed it, who, I don't know if they've enjoyed it, but there are people who have bent it to their will, who are able to use it very effectively.
Yeah, but people who aren't. If you're a science fiction writer, or you're a fiction writer, a novel writer, or a technical book writer, you're probably using, at the request of your editor, publisher, either Microsoft Word or Scrivener.
Yeah. Because most of the publishing world from... Again, you know, from things I've gathered from people who spend a lot of time there, is basically Word. And, you know, you can export from other tools, but by and large, you know, Word's what makes the publishing world go round. And so, you know, you have to spend a lot of time there. So if you are a person, you know, maybe if you are a science fiction writer or a technical book writer, then maybe you're one of these people. But if you're writing... You know, you're a person who maybe spends a lot more time with your computer and maybe, has the time to spend and the interest to expend on learning these tools. But other people, maybe not so much. You know, I know a lot of people who know, like, the one tool very well. Like, maybe they know how to go through Word and do crazy formatting and make everything do exactly what they want it to do.
Probably David Pogue.
But don't care about, like, iBooks Author, you know, and, like, making that something that they can bend to their will. Like, some people just have no interest, or, you know, like, the computer's not where I want to spend my time, or, you know, whatever. There's loads and loads of reasons why people wouldn't want to have to spend the time to do something like that. And if it was super complicated and this is something that helps simplify that, then that's great. I'm curious what's going to happen for the people who are fans of it, who do use it, who do want it to be a great thing, and Apple's just sort of letting it continue to age. You know, so, again, just like with the A-series chips, I think we're going to have to wait and see what happens with that. I would really love if it got refreshed and got the right branding, and, you know, if you just want to publish a book, you can do it straight out of to the bookstore, the Apple bookstore. You can do that straight out of Pages. But if you want to do something special, then we've got this other tool available to you. You know, sort of like, if you want to do some basic stuff with your audio, you have GarageBand, you know, and if you want to do something a little more in depth, then you have Logic. And, you know, if you want to do something basic with your audio, with your video clips, you have iMovie. But if you want to do something a little more advanced, we offer Final Cut, you know, I'm sort of hoping that's where they go with iBooks Author, is that it ends up getting spiffed up and turns into, like, the pro level tool. And if your needs are, I took a bunch of words and I put them all together in chapters and I want to put that on the store, you can do that straight from Pages, easy peasy. But for people who do a little bit more than that, you have another option.
Well, one of the things Apple does is it creates technically cool products, puts them out there in hopes that they're embraced and become sort of like the industry standard, like GarageBand. But if it doesn't work out, then Apple says, well, you know, we missed the mark on that one. As opposed to a situation where a company says, we are going to do whatever it takes to get into the publishing market, and we're going to listen to feedback, and we're going to have people tell us what they need, and even though it doesn't meet our vision and match our product design, we're going to accede to the needs of the users. Apple doesn't do that. So if it catches on and goes swimmingly, great, but it's hard. When a product doesn't catch on, then it kind of lingers because there's loyal users and Apple doesn't want to upset them.
Yeah.
So you kind of, it's the Twilight Zone.
Well, and, you know, it's harsh to have to wait and see, but, you know, for as often as we see Apple sort of march forward relentlessly, you know, sometimes we get things like this where it just sort of sits there and it's kind of in limbo and nobody really knows what's going to happen. So we'll just have to wait and see.
Yes, we will.
So, John, thank you so much for joining me today.
It was my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Of course. And this has been Mac Observer Daily Observations, Thursday, November 8th, 2018. I will talk to all of you tomorrow. And in the meantime, be excellent to each other.